He walked on and on, past corner after corner of the house, and past turret after turret, to find the door. He had to go right round to the far side before he found it. It was a huge arch, but the great iron gates stood wide open. Edmund crept up to the arch and looked inside into the courtyard, and there he saw a sight that nearly made his heart stop beating. Just inside the gate, with the moonlight shining on it, stood an enormous lion, crouched as if it was ready to spring. And Edmund stood in the shadow of the arch, afraid to go on and afraid to go back, with his knees knocking together. He stood there so long that his teeth would have been chattering with cold, even if they had not been chattering with fear. How long this really lasted, I don't know, but it seemed to Edmund to last for hours. Then at last he began to wonder why the lion was standing so still, for it hadn't moved one inch since he first set eyes on it. Edmund now ventured a little nearer, still keeping in the shadow of the arch as much as he could. He now saw from the way the lion was standing that it couldn't have been looking at him at all. But supposing it turns its head, thought Edmund. In fact, it was staring at something else, namely a little dwarf who stood with his back to it about 4 feet away. Aha, thought Edmund. When it springs at the dwarf, then will be my chance to escape. But still the lion never moved, nor did the dwarf. And now at last Edmund remembered what the others had said about the White Witch turning people into stone. Perhaps this was only a stone lion. And as soon as he had thought of that, he noticed that the lion's back and the top of its head were covered with snow. Of course, it must be only a statue. No living animal would have let itself get covered with snow. Then very slowly, and with his heart beating as if it would burst, Edmund ventured to go up to the lion. Even now he hardly dared to touch it, but at last he put out his hand very quickly and did. It was cold stone. He had been frightened of a mere statue. The relief which Edmund felt was so great that in spite of the cold, he suddenly got warm all over right down to his toes, and at the same time there came into his head what seemed a perfectly lovely idea. Probably, he thought, this is the great lion Aslan that they were all talking about. She's caught him already and turned him into stone, so that's the end of all their fine ideas about him. Pooh! Who's afraid of Aslan? And he stood there, gloating over the stone lion, and presently he did something very silly and childish. He took a stump of lead pencil out of his pocket and scribbled a moustache on the lion's upper lip, and then a pair of spectacles on its eyes. Then he said, "Yah, silly old Aslan, how'd you like being a stone? You thought yourself mighty fine, didn't you?" But in spite of the scribbles on it, the face of the great stone beast still looked so terrible and sad and noble, staring up in the moonlight, that Edmund didn't really get any fun out of jeering at it. He turned away and began to cross the courtyard. As he got to the middle of it, he saw that there were dozens of statues all about, standing here and there, rather as the pieces stand on a chessboard when it is halfway through the game. There were stone satyrs, and stone wolves, and bears and foxes, and catamountains of stone. There were lovely stone shapes that looked like women, but who were really the spirits of trees. There was the great shape of a centaur, and a winged horse, and a long, lithe creature that Edmund took to be a dragon. They all looked so strange standing there, perfectly lifelike, and also perfectly still, in the bright, cold moonlight, that it was eerie work crossing the courtyard. Right in the very middle stood a huge shape like a man, but as tall as a tree, with a fierce face and a shaggy beard and a great club in its right hand. Even though he knew that it was only a stone giant and not a live one, Edmund did not like going past it. He now saw that there was a dim light showing from a doorway on the far side of the courtyard. He went to it. There was a flight of stone steps going up to an open door. Edmund went up them. Across the threshold lay a great wolf. "It's all right, it's all right," he kept saying to himself. "It's only a stone wolf. It can't hurt me." And he raised his leg to step over it. Instantly the huge creature rose, with all the hair bristling along its back, opened a great red mouth, and said in a growling voice, "Who's there? Who's there? Stand still, stranger, and tell me who you are."
"If you please, sir,"
said Edmund, trembling so that he could hardly speak,
"my name is Edmund, and I'm the son of Adam that Her Majesty met in the wood the other day, and I've come to bring her the news that my brother and sisters are now in Narnia, quite close in the beaver's house. She wanted to see them."
"I will tell Her Majesty," said the wolf. "Meanwhile, stand still on the threshold as you value your life."
Then it vanished into the house. Edmund stood and waited, his fingers aching with cold and his heart pounding in his chest. And presently the grey wolf, Morgrim, the chief of the witch's secret police, came bounding back and said,
"Come in, come in, fortunate favourite of the Queen, or else not so fortunate."
And Edmund went in, taking great care not to tread on the wolf's paws. He found himself in a long, gloomy hall with many pillars, full, as the courtyard had been, of statues. The one nearest the door was a little fawn with a very sad expression on its face, and Edmund couldn't help wondering if this might be Lucy's friend. The only light came from a single lamp, and close beside this sat the White Witch.
"I'm come, Your Majesty,"
said Edmund, rushing eagerly forward.
"How dare you come alone?"
said the witch in a terrible voice.
"Did I not tell you to bring the others with you?"
"Please, Your Majesty," said Edmund, "I've done the best I can. I've brought them quite close. They're in the little house on the top of the dam just up the river, with Mr. and Mrs. Beaver."
A slow, cruel smile came over the witch's face.
"Is this all your news?" she asked.
"No, Your Majesty,"
said Edmund, and he proceeded to tell her all he had heard before leaving the beaver's house.
"What? Aslan?" cried the Queen. "Aslan? Is this true? If I find that you have lied to me..."
"Please, I'm only repeating what they said,"
stammered Edmund. But the Queen, who was no longer attending to him, clapped her hands. Instantly, the same dwarf, whom Edmund had seen with her before, appeared.
"Make ready our sledge," ordered the witch, "and use the harness without bells."
Chapter 10. The Spell Begins to Break. Now we must go back to Mr. and Mrs. Beaver and the three other children. As soon as Mr. Beaver said,
"There's no time to lose,"
everyone began bundling themselves into coats, except Mrs. Beaver, who started picking up sacks and laying them on the table and said,
"Now, Mr. Beaver, just reach down that ham. And here's a packet of tea, and there's sugar, and some matches. And if someone will get two or three loaves out of the crock over there in the corner..."
"What are you doing, Mrs. Beaver?"
exclaimed Susan.
"Packing a load for each of us, dearie,"
said Mrs. Beaver very coolly.
"You didn't think we'd set out on a journey with nothing to eat, did you?"
"But we haven't time,"
said Susan, buttoning the collar of her coat.
"She may be here any minute."
"That's what I say," chimed in Mr. Beaver. "Get along with you all," said his wife. "Think it over, Mr. Beaver. She can't be here for a quarter of an hour at least."
"But don't we want as big a start as we can possibly get?" said Peter. "If we're to reach the stone table before her?"
"You've got to remember that, Mrs. Beaver," said Susan. "As soon as she has looked in here and finds we're gone, she'll be off at top speed."
"That she will," said Mrs. Beaver. "But we can't get there before her, whatever we do, for she'll be on a sledge, and we'll be walking."
"Then we have no hope," said Susan.
"Now don't you get fussing, there's a dear," said Mrs. Beaver. "But just get half a dozen clean handkerchiefs out of the drawer. Course we've got a hope. We can't get there before her, but we can keep under cover and go by ways she won't expect, and perhaps we'll get through."
"That's true enough, Mrs. Beaver," said her husband. "But it's time we were out of this."
"And don't you start fussing either, Mr. Beaver," said his wife. "There, that's better. There's five loads, and the smallest for the smallest of us. That's you, my dear," she added, looking at Lucy.
"Oh, do please come on," said Lucy.
"Well, I'm nearly ready now,"
answered Mrs. Beaver at last, allowing her husband to help her into her snow boots.
"I suppose the sewing machine's too heavy to bring."
"Yes, it is," said Mr. Beaver. "A great deal too heavy. And you don't think you'll be able to use it while we're on the run, I suppose?"
"I can't abide the thought of that witch fiddling with it," said Mrs. Beaver, "and breaking it or stealing it, as likely as not."
"Oh, please, please, please do hurry," said the three children.
And so at last they all got outside, and Mr. Beaver locked the door.
"It'll delay her a bit," he said.
And they set off, all carrying their loads over their shoulders. The snow had stopped, and the moon had come out when they began their journey. They went in single file, first Mr. Beaver, then Lucy, then Peter, then Susan, and Mrs. Beaver last of all. Mr. Beaver led them across the dam and on to the right bank of the river, and then along a very rough sort of path among the trees right down by the river bank. The sides of the valley, shining in the moonlight, towered up far above them on either hand.
"Best keep down here as much as possible," he said. "She'll have to keep to the top, for you couldn't bring a sledge down here."
It would have been a pretty enough scene to look at it through a window from a comfortable armchair, and even as things were, Lucy enjoyed it at first. But as they went on walking and walking and walking, and as the sack she was carrying felt heavier and heavier, she began to wonder how she was going to keep up at all. And she stopped looking at the dazzling brightness of the frozen river with all its waterfalls of ice, and at the white masses of the treetops, and the great glaring moon, and the countless stars, and could only watch the little short legs of Mr. Beaver going pad, 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 pad through the snow in front of her, as if they were never going to stop. Then the moon disappeared, and the snow began to fall once more. And at last Lucy was so tired that she was almost asleep and walking at the same time, when suddenly she found that Mr. Beaver had turned away from the riverbank to the right and was leading them steeply uphill into the very thickest bushes. And then, as she came fully awake, she found that Mr. Beaver was just vanishing into a little hole in the bank, which had been almost hidden under the bushes until you were quite on top of it. In fact, by the time she realized what was happening, only his short, flat tail was showing. Lucy immediately stooped down and crawled in after him. Then she heard noises of scrambling and puffing and panting behind her, and in a moment all five of them were inside.
"Wherever is this?" said Peter's voice, sounding tired and pale in the darkness. I hope you know what I mean by voice sounding pale.
"It's an old hiding place for beavers in bad times," said Mr. Beaver, "and a great secret. It's not much of a place, but we must get a few hours' sleep."
"If you hadn't all been in such a plaguey fuss when we were starting, I'd have brought some pillows," said Mrs. Beaver.
It wasn't nearly such a nice cave as Mr. Tumnus's, Lucy thought. Just a hole in the ground, but dry and earthy. It was very small, so that when they all lay down, they were all a bundle of clothes together, and what with that and being warmed up by their long walk, they were really rather snug. If only the floor of the cave had been a little smoother. Then Mrs. Beaver handed round in the dark a little flask, out of which everyone drank something. It made one cough and splutter a little and stung the throat, but it also made you feel deliciously warm after you'd swallowed it. And everyone went straight to sleep. It seemed to Lucy only the next minute, though really it was hours and hours later, when she woke up feeling a little cold and dreadfully stiff and thinking how she would like a hot bath. Then she felt a set of long whiskers tickling her cheek and saw the cold daylight coming in through the mouth of the cave. But immediately after that, she was very wide awake indeed, and so was everyone else. In fact, they were all sitting up with their mouths and eyes wide open, listening to a sound which was the very sound they'd all been thinking of and sometimes imagining they heard during their walk last night. It was a sound of jingling bells. Mr. Beaver was out of the cave like a flash the moment he heard it. Perhaps you think, as Lucy thought for a moment, that this was a very silly thing to do. But it was really a very sensible one. He knew he could scramble to the top of the bank among bushes and brambles without being seen, and he wanted, above all things, to see which way the witch's sledge went. The others all sat in the cave, waiting and wondering. They waited nearly 5 minutes. Then they heard something that frightened them very much. They heard voices.
"Oh," thought Lucy, "he's been seen. She's caught him."
Great was their surprise when a little later they heard Mr. Beaver's voice calling to them from just outside the cave.
"It's all right," he was shouting. "Come out, Mrs. Beaver. Come out, sons and daughters of Adam. It's all right. It isn't her."
This was bad grammar, of course, but that is how beavers talk when they're excited. I mean, in Narnia. In our world, they usually don't talk at all. So Mrs. Beaver and the children came bundling out of the cave, all blinking in the daylight, and with earth all over them, and looking very frowsty and unbrushed and uncombed, and with sleep in their eyes.
"Come on,"
cried Mr. Beaver, who was almost dancing with delight.
"Come and see. This is a nasty knock for the witch. It looks as if her power is already crumbling."
"What do you mean, Mr. Beaver?"
panted Peter, as they all scrambled up the steep bank of the valley together.
"Didn't I tell you,"
answered Mr. Beaver,
"that she'd made it always winter and never Christmas? Didn't I tell you? Well, just come and see."
And then they were all at the top and did see. It was a sledge, and it was reindeer with bells on their harness. But they were far bigger than the witch's reindeer, and they were not white, but brown. And on the sledge sat a person whom everyone knew the moment they set eyes on him. He was a huge man in a bright red robe, bright as holly berries, with a hood that had fur inside it and a great white beard that fell like a foamy waterfall over his chest. Everyone knew him because, though you see people of his sort only in Narnia, you see pictures of them and hear them talked about even in our world, the world on this side of the wardrobe door. But when you really see them in Narnia, it is rather different. Some of the pictures of Father Christmas in our world make him look only funny and jolly. But now that the children actually stood looking at him, they didn't find it quite like that. He was so big and so glad and so real that they all became quite still. They felt very glad, but also solemn.
"I've come at last," said he. "She has kept me out for a long time, but I have got in at last. Aslan is on the move. The witch's magic is weakening."
And Lucy felt running through her that deep shiver of gladness, which you only get if you are being solemn and still.
"And now," said Father Christmas, "for your presents. There is a new and better sewing machine for you, Mrs. Beaver. I will drop it in your house as I pass."
"If you please, sir," said Mrs. Beaver, making a curtsy, "it's locked up."
"Locks and bolts make no difference to me," said Father Christmas. "And as for you, Mr. Beaver, when you get home you will find your dam finished and mended, and all the leaks stopped, and a new sluice gate fitted."
Mr. Beaver was so pleased that he opened his mouth very wide, and then found he couldn't say anything at all.
"Peter, Adam's son?" said Father Christmas.
"Here, sir," said Peter.
"These are your presents," was the answer. "And they are tools, not toys. The time to use them is perhaps near at hand. Bear them well."
With these words, he handed to Peter a shield and a sword. The shield was the color of silver, and across it there ramped a red lion, as bright as a ripe strawberry at the moment when you pick it. The hilt of the sword was of gold, and it had a sheath and a sword belt and everything it needed, and it was just the right size and weight for Peter to use. Peter was silent and solemn as he received these gifts, for he felt they were a very serious kind of present.
"Susan, Eve's daughter," said Father Christmas, "these are for you."
And he handed her a bow and a quiver full of arrows and a little ivory horn.
"You must use the bow only in great need," he said, "for I do not mean you to fight in the battle. It does not easily miss, and when you put this horn to your lips and blow it, then, wherever you are, I think help of some kind will come to you."
Last of all, he said,
"Lucy, Eve's daughter."
And Lucy came forward. He gave her a little bottle of what looked like glass, but people said afterward that it was made of diamond, and a small dagger.
"In this bottle," he said, "there is a cordial made of the juice of one of the fire flowers that grow in the mountains of the sun. If you or any of your friends is hurt, a few drops of this will restore them. And the dagger is to defend yourself at great need, for you also are not to be in the battle."
"Why, sir," said Lucy, "I think, I don't know, but I think I could be brave enough."
"That is not the point," he said. "But battles are ugly when women fight. And now..."
Here he suddenly looked less grave.
"Here is something for the moment for you all."
And he brought out, I suppose from the big bag at his back, but nobody quite saw him do it, a large tray containing 5 cups and saucers, a bowl of lump sugar, a jug of cream, and a great big teapot all sizzling and piping hot.
Then he cried out, "Merry Christmas! Long live the true king!"
And cracked his whip, and he and the reindeer and the sledge and all were out of sight before anyone realized that they had started. Peter had just drawn his sword out of its sheath and was showing it to Mr. Beaver, when Mrs. Beaver said,
now then, don't stand talking there till the tea's got cold. Just like men. Come and help to carry the tray down, and we'll have breakfast. What a mercy I thought of bringing the bread knife.
So down the steep bank they went, and back to the cave. And Mr. Beaver cut some of the bread and ham into sandwiches, and Mrs. Beaver poured out the tea, and everyone enjoyed themselves. But long before they had finished enjoying themselves, Mr. Beaver said,
"Time to be moving on now."
Chapter 11 Aslan is Nearer. Edmund, meanwhile, had been having a most disappointing time. When the dwarf had gone to get the sledge ready, he expected that the witch would start being nice to him, as she had been at their last meeting. But she said nothing at all. And when at last Edmund plucked up his courage to say,
"Please, Your Majesty, could I have some Turkish delight? You said..."
She answered,
"Silence, fool!"
And then she appeared to change her mind and said, as if to herself,
"And yet it will not do to have the brat fainting on the way."
And once more clapped her hands. Another dwarf appeared.
"Bring the human creature food and drink," she said.
The dwarf went away and presently returned, bringing an iron bowl with some water in it and an iron plate with a hunk of dry bread on it. He grinned in a repulsive manner as he set them down on the floor beside Edmund and said,
"Turkish delight for the little prince. Ha, ha, ha!"
"Take it away," said Edmund sulkily. "I don't want dry bread." But the witch suddenly turned on him with such a terrible expression on her face that he apologized and began to nibble at the bread, though it was so stale he could hardly get it down.
"You may be glad enough of it before you taste bread again," said the witch.
While he was still chewing away, the first dwarf came back and announced that the sledge was ready. The White Witch rose and went out, ordering Edmund to go with her. The snow was again falling as they came into the courtyard, but she took no notice of that, and made Edmund sit beside her on the sledge. But before they drove off, she called Mogrim, and he came bounding like an enormous dog to the side of the sledge.
"Take with you the swiftest of your wolves, and go at once to the House of the Beavers," said the witch, "and kill whatever you find there. If they are already gone, then make all speed to the stone table, but do not be seen. Wait for me there in hiding. I, meanwhile, must go many miles to the west before I find a place where I can drive across the river. You may overtake these humans before they reach the stone table. You will know what to do if you find them."
"I hear and obey, O Queen," growled the wolf,
and immediately he shot away into the snow and darkness as quickly as a horse can gallop. In a few minutes he had called another wolf, and was with him down on the dam and sniffing at the beaver's house. But of course they found it empty. It would have been a dreadful thing for the beavers and the children if the night had remained fine, for the wolves would then have been able to follow their trail, and 10 to 1 would have overtaken them before they had got to the cave. But now that the snow had begun again, the scent was cold, and even the footprints were covered up. Meanwhile the dwarf whipped up the reindeer, and the witch and Edmund drove out under the archway and on and away into the darkness and the cold. This was a terrible journey for Edmund, who had no coat. Before they had been going a quarter of an hour, all the front of him was covered with snow. He soon stopped trying to shake it off, because as quickly as he did that, a new lot gathered, and he was so tired. Soon he was wet to the skin. And oh, how miserable he was! It didn't look now as if the witch intended to make him a king. All the things he had said to make himself believe that she was good and kind, and that her side was really the right side, sounded to him silly now. He would have given anything to meet the others at this moment, even Peter. The only way to comfort himself now was to try to believe that the whole thing was a dream, and that he might wake up at any moment. And as they went on, hour after hour, it did come to seem like a dream. This lasted longer than I could describe, even if I wrote pages and pages about it. But I will skip on to the time when the snow had stopped, and the morning had come, and they were racing along in the daylight. And still they went on and on, with no sound but the everlasting swish of the snow and the creaking of the reindeer's harness. And then at last the witch said, "What have we here? Stop!" And they did. How Edmund hoped she was going to say something about breakfast. But she had stopped for quite a different reason. A little way off, at the foot of a tree, sat a merry party, a squirrel and his wife with their children, and two satyrs, and a dwarf, and an old dog fox, all on stools round a table. Edmund couldn't quite see what they were eating, but it smelled lovely, and there seemed to be decorations of holly, and he wasn't at all sure that he didn't see something like a plum pudding. At the moment when the sledge stopped, the fox, who was obviously the oldest person present, had just risen to its feet, holding a glass in its right paw, as if it was going to say something. But when the whole party saw the sledge stopping, and who was in it, all the gaiety went out of their faces. The father squirrel stopped eating with his fork halfway to his mouth, and one of the satyrs stopped with its fork actually in its mouth, and the baby squirrels squeaked with terror.
"What is the meaning of this?"
asked the witch queen. Nobody answered.
"Speak, vermin," she said again, "or do you want my dwarf to find you a tongue with his whip? What is the meaning of all this gluttony, this waste, this self-indulgence? Where did you get all these things?"
"Please, your majesty," said the fox, "we were given them, and if I might make so bold to drink your majesty's very good health..."
"Who gave them to you?"
said the witch.
"Father Christmas," stammered the fox.
"What?"
roared the witch, springing from the sledge and taking a few strides nearer to the terrified animals.
"He has not been here. He cannot have been here. How dare you? But no. Say you have been lying, and you shall even now be forgiven."
At that moment, one of the young squirrels lost its head completely.
"He has! He has! He has!"
it squeaked, beating its little spoon on the table. Edmund saw the witch bite her lips so that a drop of blood appeared on her white cheek. Then she raised her wand.
"Oh, don't! Don't! Please, don't!"
shouted Edmund. But even while he was shouting, she had waved her wand, and instantly, where the merry party had been, there were only statues of creatures, one with its stone fork fixed for ever halfway to its stone mouth, seated round a stone table on which there were stone plates and a stone plum pudding.
"As for you,"
said the witch, giving Edmund a stunning blow on the face as she remounted the sledge,
"let that teach you to ask favour for spies and traitors. Drive on."
And Edmund, for the first time in this story, felt sorry for someone besides himself. It seemed so pitiful to think of those little stone figures sitting there all the silent days and all the dark nights, year after year, till the moss grew on them, and at last even their faces crumbled away. Now they were steadily racing on again, and soon Edmund noticed that the snow which splashed against them as they rushed through it was much wetter than it had been all last night, At the same time, he noticed that he was feeling much less cold. It was also becoming foggy. In fact, every minute it grew foggier and warmer. And the sledge was not running nearly as well as it had been running up till now. At first, he thought that this was because the reindeer were tired. But soon he saw that that couldn't be the real reason. The sledge jerked and skidded and kept on jolting as if it had struck against stones. And however the dwarf whipped the poor reindeer, the sledge went slower and slower. There also seemed to be a curious noise all round them, but the noise of their driving and jolting and the dwarf shouting at the reindeer prevented Edmund from hearing what it was, until suddenly the sledge stuck so fast that it wouldn't go on at all. When that happened, there was a moment's silence, and in that silence, Edmund could at last listen to the other noise properly. A strange, sweet, rustling, chattering noise, and yet not so strange, for he'd heard it before, if only he could remember where. Then, all at once, he did remember. It was the noise of running water. All round them, though out of sight, there were streams, chattering, murmuring, bubbling, splashing, and even, in the distance, roaring. And his heart gave a great leap, though he hardly knew why, when he realized that the frost was over. And much nearer, there was a drip, drip, drip from the branches of all the trees. And then, as he looked at one tree, he saw a great load of snow slide off it, and for the first time since he had entered Narnia, he saw the dark green of a fir tree. But he hadn't time to listen or watch any longer, for the witch said, "Don't sit staring, fool! Get out and help!" And of course Edmund had to obey. He stepped out into the snow, but it was really only slush by now, and began helping the dwarf to get the sledge out of the muddy hole it had got into. They got it out in the end, and by being very cruel to the reindeer, the dwarf managed to get it on the move again, and they drove a little further. And now the snow was really melting in earnest, and patches of green grass were beginning to appear in every direction. Unless you have looked at a world of snow as long as Edmund had been looking at it, you will hardly be able to imagine what a relief those green patches were after the endless white. Then the sledge stopped again.
"It's no good, Your Majesty," said the dwarf. "We can't sledge in this thaw."
"Then we must walk," said the witch.
"We shall never overtake them walking," growled the dwarf. "Not with the start they've got."
"Are you my counsellor or my slave?" said the witch. "Do as you're told. Tie the hands of the human creature behind it, and keep hold of the end of the rope, and take your whip, and cut the harness of the reindeer. They'll find their own way home."
The dwarf obeyed, and in a few minutes, Edmund found himself being forced to walk as fast as he could with his hands tied behind him. He kept on slipping in the slush and mud and wet grass, and every time he slipped, the dwarf gave him a curse and sometimes a flick with the whip. The witch walked behind the dwarf and kept on saying, "Faster! Faster!" Every moment the patches of green grew bigger and the patches of snow grew smaller. Every moment more and more of the trees shook off their robes of snow. Soon, wherever you looked, instead of white shapes you saw the dark green of firs or the black prickly branches of bare oaks and beeches and elms. Then the mist turned from white to gold, and presently cleared away altogether. Shafts of delicious sunlight struck down onto the forest floor, and overhead you could see a blue sky between the treetops. Soon there were more wonderful things happening. Coming suddenly round a corner into a glade of silver birch trees, Edmund saw the ground covered in all directions with little yellow flowers, celandines. The noise of water grew louder. Presently, they actually crossed a stream. Beyond it, they found snowdrops growing,
"Mind your own business,"
said the dwarf when he saw that Edmund had turned his head to look at them, and he gave the rope a vicious jerk. But of course this didn't prevent Edmund from seeing. Only 5 minutes later he noticed a dozen crocuses growing round the foot of an old tree, gold and purple and white. Then came a sound even more delicious than the sound of the water. Close beside the path they were following, a bird suddenly chirped from the branch of a tree. It was answered by the chuckle of another bird a little further off, and then, as if that had been a signal, there was chattering and chirruping in every direction, and then a moment of full song, and within 5 minutes the whole wood was ringing with birds' music. And wherever Edmund's eyes turned, he saw birds alighting on branches, or sailing overhead, or chasing one another, or having their little quarrels, or tidying up their feathers with their beaks.
"Faster! Faster!" said the witch.
There was no trace of the fog now. The sky became bluer and bluer, and now there were white clouds hurrying across it from time to time. In the wide glades there were primroses. A light breeze sprang up, which scattered drops of moisture from the swaying branches and carried cool, delicious scents against the faces of the travellers. The trees began to come fully alive. The larches and birches were covered with green, the laburnums with gold. Soon the beech trees had put forth their delicate, transparent leaves. As the travellers walked under them, the light also became green. A bee buzzed across their path.
"This is no thaw," said the dwarf, suddenly stopping. "This is spring. What are we to do? Your winter has been destroyed. I tell you, this is Aslan's doing." "If either of you mentions that name again," said the witch, "he shall instantly be killed."
Chapter 12 Peter's First Battle. While the dwarf and the white witch were saying this, miles away the beavers and the children were walking on, hour after hour, into what seemed a delicious dream. Long ago they had left their coats behind them, and by now they had even stopped saying to one another, "Look, there's a kingfisher," or, "I say, bluebells," or, "What was that lovely smell?" or, "Just listen to that thrush!" They walked on in silence, drinking it all in, passing through patches of warm sunlight into cool green thickets and out again into wide mossy glades where tall elms raised the leafy roof far overhead, and then into dense masses of flowering currant and among hawthorn bushes where the sweet smell was almost overpowering. They had been just as surprised as Edmund when they saw the winter vanishing and the whole wood passing in a few hours or so from January to May. They hadn't even known for certain, as the witch did, that this was what would happen when Aslan came to Narnia. But they all knew that it was her spells which had produced the endless winter, and therefore they all knew when this magic spring began that something had gone wrong, and badly wrong, with the witch's schemes. And after the thaw had been going on for some time, they all realized that the witch would no longer be able to use her sledge. After that, they didn't hurry so much, and they allowed themselves more rests and longer ones. They were pretty tired by now, of course, but not what I'd call bitterly tired, only slow and feeling very dreamy and quiet inside, as one does when one is coming to the end of a long day in the open. Susan had a slight blister on one heel. They had left the course of the big river some time ago, for one had to turn a little to the right, that meant a little to the south, to reach the place of the stone table. Even if this had not been their way, they couldn't have kept to the river valley once the thaw began, for with all that melting snow, the river was soon in flood, a wonderful, roaring, thundering yellow flood, and their path would have been under water. And now the sun got low, and the light got redder, and the shadows got longer, and the flowers began to think about closing.
"Not long now,"
said Mr. Beaver, and began leading them uphill across some very deep springy moss. It felt nice under their tired feet, in a place where only tall trees grew, very wide apart. The climb, coming at the end of the long day, made them all pant and blow. And just as Lucy was wondering whether she could really get to the top without another long rest, suddenly they were at the top. And this is what they saw. They were on a green open space from which you could look down on the forest, spreading as far as one could see in every direction, except right ahead. There, far to the east, was something twinkling and moving.
"By gum,"
whispered Peter to Susan.
"The sea."
In the very middle of this open hilltop was the stone table. It was a great grim slab of grey stone supported on four upright stones. It looked very old, and it was cut all over with strange lines and figures that might be the letters of an unknown language. They gave you a curious feeling when you looked at them. The next thing they saw was a pavilion pitched on one side of the open place. A wonderful pavilion it was, and especially now when the light of the setting sun fell upon it, with sides of what looked like yellow silk and cords of crimson and tent pegs of ivory, and high above it on a pole a banner which bore a red rampant lion fluttering in the breeze, which was blowing in their faces from the far-off sea. While they were looking at this, they heard the sound of music on their right, and turning in that direction, they saw what they had come to see. Aslan stood in the center of a crowd of creatures who had grouped themselves round him in the shape of a half-moon. There were tree women there, and well women, dryads and naiads, as they used to be called in our world, who had stringed instruments. It was they who had made the music. There were four great centaurs. The horse part of them was like huge English farm horses, and the man part was like stern but beautiful giants. There was also a unicorn, and a bull with the head of a man, and a pelican, and an eagle, and a great dog. And next to Aslan stood two leopards, of whom one carried his crown and the other his standard. But as for Aslan himself, the beavers and the children didn't know what to do or say when they saw him. People who have not been in Narnia sometimes think that a thing cannot be good and terrible at the same time. If the children had ever thought so, they were cured of it now. For when they tried to look at Aslan's face, they just caught a glimpse of the golden mane and the great, royal, solemn, overwhelming eyes. And then they found they couldn't look at him and went all trembly.
"Go on,"
whispered Mr. Beaver.
"No," whispered Peter. "You first." "No, sons of Adam before animals,"
whispered Mr. Beaver back again.
"Susan,"
whispered Peter,
"what about you? Ladies first."
"No, you're the eldest,"
whispered Susan. And of course, the longer they went on doing this, the more awkward they felt. Then at last Peter realized that it was up to him. He drew his sword and raised it to the salute, and hastily saying to the others, "Come on, pull yourselves together," he advanced to the lion and said, "We have come, Aslan."
"Welcome, Peter, son of Adam," said Aslan. "Welcome, Susan and Lucy, daughters of Eve. Welcome, he-beaver and she-beaver."
His voice was deep and rich, and somehow took the fidgets out of them. They now felt glad and quiet, and it didn't seem awkward to them to stand and say nothing.
"But where is the fourth?" asked Aslan.
"He has tried to betray them and join the White Witch, O Aslan," said Mr. Beaver.
And then something made Peter say, "That was partly my fault, Aslan. I was angry with him, and I think that helped him to go wrong." And Aslan said nothing either to excuse Peter or to blame him, but merely stood looking at him with his great, unchanging eyes. And it seemed to all of them that there was nothing to be said.
"Please, Aslan," said Lucy, "can anything be done to save Edmund?"
"All shall be done," said Aslan, "but it may be harder than you think."
And then he was silent again for some time. Up to that moment, Lucy had been thinking how royal and strong and peaceful his face looked. Now it suddenly came into her head that he looked sad as well. But next minute that expression was quite gone. The lion shook his mane and clapped his paws together.
Terrible paws, thought Lucy, if he didn't know how to velvet them.
And said,
"Meanwhile, let the feast be prepared. Ladies, take these daughters of Eve to the pavilion and minister to them."
When the girls had gone, Aslan laid his paw, and though it was velveted, it was very heavy, on Peter's shoulder, and said,
"Come, son of Adam, and I will show you a far-off sight of the castle where you are to be king."
And Peter, with his sword still drawn in his hand, went with the lion to the eastern edge of the hilltop. There, a beautiful sight met their eyes. The sun was setting behind their backs. That meant that the whole country below them lay in the evening light, forest and hills and valleys, and, winding away like a silver snake, the lower part of the great river. And beyond all this, miles away, was the sea. And beyond the sea, the sky, full of clouds which were just turning rose color with the reflection of the sunset. But just where the land of Narnia met the sea, in fact at the mouth of the great river, there was something on a little hill shining. It was shining because it was a castle, and of course the sunlight was reflected from all the windows which looked toward Peter and the sunset. But to Peter, it looked like a great star resting on the seashore.
"That, O man," said Aslan, "is Caer Paravel of the Four Thrones, in one of which you must sit as king. I show it to you because you are the firstborn, and you will be high king over all the rest."
And once more Peter said nothing, for at that moment a strange noise woke the silence suddenly. It was like a bugle, but richer.
"It is your sister's horn," said Aslan to Peter in a low voice, so low as to be almost a purr, if it is not disrespectful to think of a lion purring.
For a moment Peter did not understand. Then, when he saw all the other creatures start forward and heard Aslan say with a wave of his paw,
"Back! Let the prince win his spurs!"
he did understand, and set off running as hard as he could to the pavilion, and there he saw a dreadful sight. The naiads and dryads were scattering in every direction. Lucy was running toward him as fast as her short legs would carry her, and her face was as white as paper. Then he saw Susan make a dash for a tree and swing herself up, followed by a huge grey beast. At first, Peter thought it was a bear. Then he saw that it looked like an Alsatian, though it was far too big to be a dog. Then he realized that it was a wolf. A wolf standing on its hind legs, with its front paws against the tree trunk, snapping and snarling. All the hair on its back stood up on end. Susan had not been able to get higher than the second big branch. One of her legs hung down so that her foot was only an inch or two above the snapping teeth. Peter wondered why she did not get higher, or at least take a better grip. Then he realized that she was just going to faint, and that if she fainted, she would fall off. Peter did not feel very brave. Indeed, he felt he was going to be sick, but that made no difference to what he had to do. He rushed straight up to the monster and aimed a slash of his sword at its side. That stroke never reached the wolf. Quick as lightning, it turned round, its eyes flaming and its mouth wide open in a howl of anger. If it had not been so angry that it simply had to howl, it would have got him by the throat at once. As it was, though all this happened too quickly for Peter to think at all, he had just time to duck down and plunge his sword as hard as he could between the brute's forelegs into its heart. Then came a horrible, confused moment like something in a nightmare. He was tugging and pulling, and the wolf seemed neither alive nor dead, and its bared teeth knocked against his forehead, and everything was blood and heat and hair. A moment later he found that the monster lay dead, and he had drawn his sword out of it, and was straightening his back and rubbing the sweat off his face and out of his eyes. He felt tired all over. Then, after a bit, Susan came down the tree. She and Peter felt pretty shaky when they met, and I won't say there wasn't kissing and crying on both sides. But in Narnia, no one thinks any the worse of you for that.
"Quick! Quick!"
shouted the voice of Aslan.
"Centaurs! Eagles! I see another wolf in the thickets! There, behind you! He has just darted away! After him, all of you! He will be going to his mistress! Now is your chance to find the witch and rescue the fourth son of Adam!"
And instantly, with a thunder of hoofs and a beating of wings, a dozen or so of the swiftest creatures disappeared into the gathering darkness. Peter, still out of breath, turned and saw Aslan close at hand.
"You have forgotten to clean your sword," said Aslan.
It was true. Peter blushed when he looked at the bright blade and saw it all smeared with the wolf's hair and blood. He stooped down and wiped it quite clean on the grass, and then wiped it quite dry on his coat.
"Hand it to me and kneel, son of Adam," said Aslan.
And when Peter had done so, he struck him with the flat of the blade and said,
"Rise up, Sir Peter Wolfsbane, and whatever happens, never forget to wipe your sword."
Chapter 13. Deep Magic from the Dawn of Time. Now we must get back to Edmund. When he had been made to walk far further than he had ever known that anybody could walk, the witch at last halted in a dark valley, all overshadowed with fir trees and yew trees. Edmund simply sank down and lay on his face, doing nothing at all, and not even caring what was going to happen next, provided they would let him lie still. He was too tired even to notice how hungry and thirsty he was. The witch and the dwarf were talking close beside him, in low tones.
"No," said the dwarf. "It's no use now, O Queen. They must have reached the stone table by now."
"Perhaps the wolf will smell us out and bring us news," said the witch.
"It cannot be good news if he does," said the dwarf.
"Four thrones in Caer Paravel," said the witch. "How if only three were filled? That would not fulfill the prophecy."
"What difference would that make now that he is here?"
said the dwarf. He did not dare even now to mention the name of Aslan to his mistress.
"He may not stay long, and then we would fall upon the three at Caer.
yet it might be